Hi there, and welcome to Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett on Empower Radio. Thanks for listening. I appreciate you tuning in. Hope you're having a great time. Wanted to focus today on resetting, reformatting the hard drive, reconnecting, fashioning your view and your perception, the way you work with reality. And who better to do that than a creativity coach? Eric Mizell, you may have read 80 billion of his books, but maybe you haven't read this one because it's the newest. All right. Ha 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 ha. So if you think you know where I'm going with this, no. And before we started talking about this, Eric informed me he's going to be oppositional. So we're going to hold him to that. All right. So as we work through this, remember, there's some counterintuitive stuff going on and it all has a meaning. And your goal, your role is to dissect the important stuff and make it work. How's that? All right. We're on. Hi, Eric. How are you doing?
Hi, Wendy. I'm great. How are you today?
Pretty darn good. Thank you. All sorts of excitement, enthusiasm. Things are happening. It's kind of fun to sit here and contemplate new ways of creating things. And your Life Purpose Bootcamp gives people an 8-week program that they can go back and look at their life and see how it stacks up. And if they're looking for something with more meaning, this is the game plan.
That's right. There are lots of life purpose books out there, but they're pretty much predicated on the older paradigm, the paradigm I think we want to move away from, and that's the paradigm where meaning is out there somewhere, that it's an objective thing on the top of a mountain or in some philosophy or in some guru's book. It's time to move to the idea that meaning is a subjective psychological experience of a certain sort, because that's what it is. And when we start to get that, then we get the idea that we can influence and create meaning and that we can create our life purpose choices around our understanding of meaning.
Now, you've had some feedback on this and you include that in the book about how people have changed their lives with this type of formula. And what would be the most, I guess, the complicated part in working this routine?
Oh, living it. That's simple to say. Because let's say that you do the work of the early weeks and you do some interesting work around creating your menu of meaning opportunities, which is an idea in the book, and then you formulate your life purpose choices and you get them articulated really beautifully. Now comes the work of living them. And our to-do list, our daily to-do list, doesn't have our life purposes on it. It has everything else. It has our errands and our responsibilities and our day job and our this and our that. So that's the hardest part of the work, is actually living the life purposes that we've discerned are really the ones we want to stand behind.
Well, when you're talking about going through and trying to determine what has value and meaning and all of this stuff, that to me is just a little bit muddy.
Sure. Well, let's take it sort of step by step. If you agree, if you decide that meaning is a certain kind of psychological experience, then there's a simple question to ask, and that's, what has provoked that experience in you in the past? What's felt meaningful? And when folks sit down and try to figure that out, and if they're honest about it, they'll discover that maybe their, 7 years in their PhD program wasn't really very meaningful at all, but holding their child's hand crossing the street is meaningful, or having those conversations with your crazy Aunt Rose about family secrets, that was really meaningful. So once we're a little more clear and a little more honest about what actually has felt meaningful in life, then we can create a menu of future things based on our past experiences. And that's what I'm calling a menu of meaning opportunities. And those come in rather large categories. And human beings have always known this, but haven't typically created this kind of menu. Those large categories are creating and relationships and service and activism, etc. We could name all the categories, and they're named in the book. When you get that picture of, okay, these are the kinds of things that give me the experience of meaning, sometimes do, there's no guarantee, but often do, then you can begin to see how you can construct a day around your meaning opportunities. You can say, I'm going to spend that first hour in the morning creating, or I'm going to spend an important hour with my mate. I'm going to push aside all the other things that are on my to-do list. I'm going to actually spend that hour with my mate because that's meaningful to me. Or I'm going to have that hard conversation with my daughter about her drinking, or whatever. And this is a much more intentional way of living, organized around both your meaning opportunities and the actual choices you're making. as to how you want to be in life, how you want to represent yourself in life.
What I see here in the entire book that I think is really crucial and a very helpful part of this puzzle is the week three, upgrading your personality.
Yeah, we're often not quite equal to living the life purpose choices we make. It's one thing to decide that your life purpose choice is to, let's just take one example, write wonderful fiction. But if you're also an addict and your day is organized around getting a fix, then it's going to be hard to work on writing your novel. So then dealing with your addiction becomes one of your life purpose choices. And I'm using the phrase upgrading your personality to stand for the changes we need to make in order to be able to live the choices we've chosen. And I have a personality model, a little three-part model, where it goes as follows, that we come into life with some original personality, with endowments and proclivities and temperaments and what have you. And anybody who's had kids or kittens or puppies knows that creatures come into the world different already. We're already somebody when we come into the world. So there's original personality, and then there's formed personality, the person we become over time through the constraints of living and via our parents and school and all of those things that constrain us. And then there's the third part, available personality, and that's our remaining freedom, the freedom we have left to look our formed personality in the eye and make the changes we need to make. And each individual is going to have more or less available personality. To use the example of the addict, an addict can have less available personality until he enters into recovery. So in this model, what we're talking about is using your available personality to, so to speak, upgrade your formed personality.
Part of this, I think, you know, it matches the terminology that they use, like resonate at the same frequency or vibrate in harmony with the outcome you wish to achieve. And you give actual manifest, concrete form to this, because to me, it says the same thing. I want to achieve this. Well, how do I do it? I have to reflect, or I have to become something that is in sync with the outcome I'm envisioning. And that stuff gets glossed over in all of the, and I don't, it's not new age, it may be new thinking, but reformatted or current right now, it seems to be the trending way of dealing with creating your form or your new way of dealing with the world. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think it's straightforward. I think we're both saying the same thing straightforwardly, which is if you want something to happen, you need to be the person equal to making that thing happen. That could mean anything under the sun. Just to take a simple example, the number one phobia in the world is public speaking. People are more scared of getting up and speaking for 2 minutes than flying or crossing bridges or handling spiders or whatever. So that's interesting, because that means that if one of your life purpose choices is, let's say, to be an activist of a certain sort and speak truth to power, well, if you want to speak truth to power and you're afraid of speaking, like so many people are, then you've got to deal with your fear of speaking in order to be the person you want to be. And that's just one of a trillion possible examples of how we need to deal with our, let's call them weaknesses or shortfalls or whatever it is that stands in the way between us doing the work we intend to do in life.
We're talking with Eric Mizell, and he's well-known as a creativity coach. For years, you know, the books have been out there for people to use. So if you're listening, you might know him for Coaching the Artist Within or Mastering Creative Anxiety or Fearless Creating. There was one you did on depression, saying we have to rethink depression and what it is as a dis-ease. Can you address that for just a second? Because people who are wanting to make change, that's one of the stoppers.
Yeah. It's a big subject, of course, and just so folks know, I'm running a free symposium called The Future of Mental Health, where I'm interviewing folks from around the world on the subject of the changes in mental health that we need to make. So if people are interested in that, just come to my site, ericmazel.com, and get your free ticket to that symposium. It runs in February for, I think, five consecutive nights. It's a big subject. I've done two books directly on so-called depression. One is Rethinking Depression, and the other is more for creative folks, called The Van Gogh Blues. In that book, I talk about existential sadness as the primary problem that creative people face. But let me try to back off or back up and talk about these issues more generally. There's a big debate going on, and I'm in one camp, but there's a big debate going on as to whether there are any mental disorders or not. And that is, there's phenomena, there's sadness, there's hearing voices, there's anxiety. There are all kinds of things that exist. That's not up for debate. People get sad. That's not up for debate. What's up for debate is if you walk into a provider's office and say you're sad, and you're handed back a diagnostic label of clinical depression, what kind of transaction is that? Did something medical-looking really go on there? Or were you just handed a label provided by a certain book? It's called the DSM, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. Did anything medical go on, or were you just handed a label? And this is a big question. And the second question is, well, if you're just handed a label and nothing medical is really going on, why are you being prescribed something? How can there be medication for something that isn't medical? And as I say, there's a huge debate going on here. I do not believe that psychiatric medications are medicine. I believe they're chemicals with powerful effects. And some people may want those effects and other people may not. But it's very difficult to think of these, it's very different to think of these things as chemicals with effects rather than medication for an illness. Let me just go one step further and give an analogy. If a raging rhino is coming at you, we have tranquilizer darts that can put it down. But that doesn't mean we know anything about why it was raging or whether it had a medical issue as to why it was raging. Maybe it just wanted to eat us or attack us. And that's what a lot of our chemicals do. We know how to provide effects to people, but that doesn't mean we know what's going on in their system or that anything incorrect is going on in their system. And this is especially true with children. And I know I'm going on here, but this is a hobby horse of mine. Right now, 1 in 13 children are on psychiatric meds. And if you happen to fall into certain systems, like the California foster care system, the number zooms up to 1 in 4. So kids are on these meds for squirming in school and for saying no to their parents and what have you, for things that are not medical conditions. But they're on, so to speak, medication for non-medical conditions. So we have a huge problem here. Pharmaceutical companies are driving this way of looking at things. And there are groups, it's called the anti-psychiatry movement or the critical psychiatry movement, I'm part of all of that, that don't agree that what we're looking at are actual pseudo-medical disorders.
Part of this, I think, is perfect timing in terms of, and we're going to make another analogy, with the declassifying marijuana from a felony. You know, I knew people years ago who with possession went to prison, and that was it. Somebody, you could shoot a gun, you could be in a robbery, and you would have less time than having possession of marijuana. I think society is changing in a lot of different ways and finally saying, you know, there are more powerful and more harmful drugs that we are prescribing than those that we have outlawed. And that's just a dynamic. It's a paradigm shift is what it is, in my opinion.
Yeah, and so much of this is about social control, you know, to choose to give harsher sentences for the drug of choice of African Americans than the drug of choice of white people. That's a social control issue, etc. And a lot of what goes on in psychiatry is social control too.
I see. I think that the deal is when you prescribe something, it alters the blood, the body chemistry. So then you have a whole different sort of problem arise than the one you're trying to buffer or subdue. And there's no remedy for that. And that's really glossed over, that you have these incredible side effects that alter the personality in different ways. And then depending on how long you've been on that drug, create other problems in terms of health in the patient.
Absolutely. And for folks who are interested in this, Joanna Moncrief is a British psychiatrist who's written extensively in this area. I would recommend a couple of her books for folks who are interested in this area. One is called The Myth of the Chemical Cure. One is called Demedicalizing Misery. And a third is called The Bitterest Pill. And that's about antipsychotic drugs. There's a lot of good reading out there, but unfortunately, folks are bombarded by pharmaceutical ads, drug ads all day long, and people are hard-pressed not to buy the medical model, that something's blown in through the window into their brain or into their system and is causing everything from too short eyelashes or too long eyelashes or whatever it is, and that there's a drug to cure that disorder. So it's hard for the voices, I want to say the voices of reason, it's hard for the voices on the other side of the equation to get heard when the airwaves are taken over by pharmaceutical companies.
The benefit I have in the way that I do the program and the way that I think and I see the world, which goes along with that existential kind of thing, is that when we start bringing our own awareness, our own self-worth back into the equation, we begin to question all of the external drama and diagnoses and labels and say, what value does this have in my life? And how does this empower me to be a more creative and whatever, compassionate, caring, productive human being? And that's where your work comes in. The Life Purpose Bootcamp. You go back and you start reformatting the hard drive and saying, what do I have that has meaning and value in my life? And how can I showcase and emphasize that? And then you work on the problems. What would be my self-sabotage action? And then you go back into just becoming more comfortable allowing your inner voice and your own needs to be prioritized. And some of this, you talk about one woman who had a difficult time making time out to just, you know, enjoy things or relax, and seeing that as self as a sabotage.
Absolutely. And you use the word existential, which is, of course, a word I use a lot, and I come out of the existential tradition. And one of the hallmarks of the existential tradition was the idea of personal responsibility, that folks actually had to take responsibility for themselves, had to look in the mirror and see what was going on. We talked about that a moment ago, about upgrading your personality. That's a looking in the mirror activity. A second looking in the mirror activity is taking a look at your actual circumstances and changing those circumstances that interfere with your life purpose choices, that interfere with the way you actually want to live your life. And this is, of course, remarkably or amazingly difficult to do, changing circumstances. I've been running a series of interviewing folks for another kind of symposium. And one of the things that's come up is how long it took all of them individually to make a big change, even after the meaning had completely drained out of the thing they were doing. They entirely understood that they no longer wanted to be doing the thing they were doing. Things like being a faculty member teaching music composition, or one woman was a nun, Mother Teresa's right-hand nun, and no longer believed in Mother Teresa or God or her order. It still took, on average, 5 to 6 years to make a change, even after one knew the change had to be made, which is very interesting and very poignant, how long it takes us. And there's some obvious reasons, obvious enough. One is, you know, who wants to give up tenure? Who wants to give up that kind of security?
Or finance,
who can really give up financial? Who can really give up a whole belief system that easily? Coupled with the fact that whatever you choose next comes with no guarantees. And that's a big deal point, because if I could guarantee that the next thing you choose will work remarkably better than the thing you've previously chosen, you'd move towards it a little more quickly. But I can't give you that guarantee. Nothing in life can give you that guarantee. So people are spending, let's just pick a round number, 5 years between the changes they need to make. And that's a lot of life goes by with people stuck in circumstances they know are not working, but not quite having the wherewithal to making the change they need to make.
But I think it's brilliant. I love that you have a timetable on it, that it says 5 years, because you know what? I have gone through in my life different phases, accepting my intuitive abilities, accepting some of the things that I didn't need to do as a career, but found that they were helpful, and being in that process of, I know I don't belong here, but I need this to get from point A to point B. And it did come in handy. And if I go back and look at it, it was about 5 to 7 years between those shifts. But all the while, I was working. I didn't stop. I didn't give up. I didn't say no. I kept doing little teeny tiny steps that brought into my circle the things that would help me establish this foundation. I love the fact that you have some kind of a time frame, because I think that gives people hope.
Yes, I agree and I disagree. I agree that one does work in that five-year period towards the change, and that's very valuable. Where I don't agree is that it's a really useful length of time. I think it ought to be shorter. I think people would feel better in life if they could make those changes a little more expeditiously, because usually people are sad during that period. I'm not saying you were, but people are usually sad because they're not really experiencing life as meaningful. That's really the point, that the meaning has drained out of whatever they're involved with, whether it's a relationship or a job or what have you. So I agree that people are working towards the change in that period, but I just think it would be lovely if that period could be a little shorter so that people would be in pain less long.
Okay, and I love that because that's the oppositional thing we promised at the beginning. Yes, slam dunk, got it. Okay, now, I do want to say, you betcha I was sad. You betcha I was uncomfortable. You betcha I was going, why? No, crap, darn, yow. And what did that do? Well, for a little while, I had to sit in it and I had to say, why? Why? Why this? Why? Well, what else? What next? What if? So all of that stewing and that sorrow for me, everybody's different. This is not a quick fix for anybody, but it was a way of me acknowledging my output did not measure with what my expectation was going to be. And I had to make changes. It wasn't going to change for me. I'd love to have done that. I believe in this creative, the affirmations, creative manifestation. I believe in all of that, but it doesn't get us out of the pit, whether it's a money pit or a psychological pit of despair. It doesn't preempt us from having those very real and human emotions. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And that's why, as you asked the question, what's the hardest part of all of this? Living it is the hardest part of it. And so that's why I have lots of practical tools and strategies for getting your life purposes onto your daily to-do list. Because what you were just saying, if you're in this long kind of sad and tumultuous period of making a change, you may be approaching your next life purpose choice, but you may on all of those days not be living your life purposes currently, be in some kind of odd state between life purposes. That's why I think it's so important to know how to get your life purposes onto your daily to-do list. And let me just mention a few of those simple tactics just to flesh this out a tiny bit. I think one thing of value is to engage, for people to engage in a morning meaning check-in. It can just take 15 seconds. This is not heavy lifting. But just to look at your day, and rather than organizing your day around errands and tasks and what have you, to organize it around meaning and to say to yourself, I want to make a meaning investment from 6 a.m. to 7 a.m. in writing my novel, and I want to make a meaning investment from noon to one, getting out into nature, etc., whatever it is for the individual. But by having this morning meaning check-in, it alters the way you look at your day. It makes your day much more of a negotiation around your life purposes. And even if many of the things on your daily to-do list don't feel meaningful, maybe the commute doesn't feel meaningful or your day job doesn't feel meaningful or what have you, at least by looking at life this way and picking your meaning opportunities in the morning, at least some hours of your day can feel meaningful. And for many people, that's an upgrade. It's an upgrade that any hours of their day feel meaningful. So that's one simple practical thing that a person can try to get their life purposes.
That's one. Okay, we're going to have to take a break here real quick. So before we get into more, because I want you to continue with that too.
You bet.
But I'm also going to add another element. This was my morning meaningful moment, and I do hear voices. I do connect with that essence I call divine spirit. And this morning, and they had been telling me, my guidance, my awareness, my intuition had been saying, don't cover your face when you sleep. Don't hide under the pillow. Don't put the comforter over your face. This morning, I woke up out of a dead sleep. I do out of body stuff. I'm very aware of that lucid dreaming and all of that. And I had a pillow right on my neck with a very heavy cat perched on top of this pillow, a dead sleep. And I wake up, I'm going, oh, that's why. Yeah. Okay. I'm so grateful to be breathing and alive. And Chloe, could you please move? All right. right. That was my morning. Well, but I do on a regular basis. I'm like, thank you. Okay. What's up today? But it was so funny because I had had this constant, you know, last maybe 3 or 4 weeks, focus of don't cover your head. Okay, fine. I moved the pillow. Okay. And then this morning there it was and there she was. I'm like, yeah.
So oh, Chloe didn't have check. To feel guilty for all time smothering her mystery.
I think Chloe did that to serve me a little purpose of reminding, see here, you have consequences. So we're going to take a break. Talking again with Eric Maisel, Life Purpose Bootcamp. You can create the life you want. Get in the program, do the 8-week plan, or check out some of his other information too on his website. We're going to be back with more here on Empower Radio. Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett. Thanks for tagging along.
I'm home, and I love it. I'm home where I belong. I'm home, and I love it. I'm home where I belong.
It's always nice to come home, but these days, many Americans are at risk of foreclosure and losing their homes. Fortunately, help is available. Making Home Affordable is a free program from the U.S. government that has already helped over 1 million struggling homeowners, and we want to help you.
I'm home.
I'm home.
And I love it. I'm home.
I'm home.
Find out now what your options are. Go to makinghomeaffordable.gov or call 1-888-995-HOPE. The sooner you act, the better chance we can help you.
I'm home.
I'm home.
Where I be.
Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Come to the forest. It's a place not so far away. A place where you don't have to mow the lawn or babysit.
I saw lizards and squirrels and bugs.
Ladybugs, caterpillars. It's really cool, actually.
A place where you don't have to make time for free time.
Lots and lots of kinds of species here.
Out here, you may even meet the mysterious creature known as the other you. The enchanted you.
It's magic what flowers do.
The adventurous you.
My favorite tree, yes, is that one.
The free-to-be-me you. Ask your parents to take you to this not-so-far-away place. Come to the forest, where the other you lives. But first, stop by discovertheforest.org, a public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Have you ever lost a cat? And have you ever wanted to get your cat back after you lost it? Hi there, I'm Andrew Hoffman. I went on this website called InventNow.org. Then I decided to make an invention of my own. It's called the Lost Cat Magnet Invention. So you can get your cat back after you lost it. Just turn it on and lost cat stick to it. That's a good cat. If your cat was hiding up in a tree, it won't be up a tree anymore. It will be stuck to the lost cat magnet. And sometimes they fly toward you in the air. Just listen to one satisfied cat. See? That's proof. You should go to the InventNow.org website too. But just remember one thing. Don't do a lost cat magnet.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions or just play some games at InventNow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Hi there. We're talking with creativity coach Eric Maisel. This book is Life Purpose Bootcamp, the 8-week plan, breakthrough plan for creating a meaningful life. And there are several other books out there. If you're an artist, if you're a creative person, if you're intuitive, if you just want a little jump start in your perspective and a way of giving you maybe a more hands-on approach to making some needed changes, any of his books would work, okay? And I liked it when we talked about the existential sadness. I wanted to get into more of that, but first you were talking about the little tools, and one was that morning moment where you kind of focus, and then Chloe got in the way.
Well, let me just mention one more because I like it. So there's the morning meaning check-in. Then there's the idea of what I call a life purpose icon. And it struck me that Christians get so much information and resonance and support from the from their cross they wear around their neck, or Jews get so much from the Star of David, but individuals don't tend to dream up the idea of creating a life purpose icon that works in the same way for them, mainly because I think the idea just never crosses their mind to fabricate an image that does that kind of work. So I suggest that in the book, and people are coming up with, just as you would imagine, all kinds of idiosyncratic things, whether it's a lightning bolt or an acorn or a praying mantis or a lighthouse or a walking stick, whatever it is. Folks are kind of instantly getting that even though life purposes are complicated and often wordy and sort of come as lists, nevertheless, there's a way to somehow encapsulate all of that in a single image that holds meaning for the individual. So I think that's another thing to do, is to spend the time and come up with your life purpose icon and actually go to the local jeweler or do it yourself and have it fabricated and end up with something that's tangible that reminds you on a daily basis of what your life purpose choices are.
Well, and see, you that was, amazingly enough, I was going with that chapter 7 where you talk about that. And the people in here who, let's just to give a few examples, you have to read the rest of the book. I'm not going to give the whole thing away. Mm-hmm. Okay, you've got a rock guy. And so he was thinking about doing rocks and trying to figure out what would come to mind. And then he, after waffling and trying to, you know, contemplating his navel, he decided that there's a smooth stone. He looked at it, imprinted it, and when he visualizes that, he doesn't have to actually have the manifest thing. Versus somebody else who has a lighthouse and somebody else who has a walking stick. Mm-hmm. So it's very personal. Very personal, these things that people, you know, bring into their awareness as focal points.
Yeah, let me piggyback on that, because the pebble stone, polished stone, reminds me of the following. So an elementary school teacher dropped me an email some years back. I don't know what grade it was. Let's call it third grade. And she said she decided she wanted to talk to her kids about meaning, that she'd been reading my books, and she just thought it was sensible to talk to her third graders about meaning. But, of course, she had to do it in a third grade appropriate way. So she took them out to a dry stream bed and had them pick out their own polished stone, polished pebble, large enough to hold a word. And so they went back to the classroom, and each child were given those art supplies that allow you to write on a rock. And they were told to choose a word that they wanted to represent how they wanted to be this school year. Be any word they wanted, calm or whatever. And then they kept that stone, that iconic stone, on their desk the whole school year with their word facing them. She said she'd never had a better behaved class, a better organized class, a more alert class. It just worked. And so if a third grader can pick an icon and a word, I think we as adults can do that too. And what's lovely about what she had them do was that marriage of the visual, iconic, tangible thing, a stone, and language, because language is so powerful and we want language to work for us. That marriage of language and a tangible object, I think it's just a wonderful mixture.
And to me, I see that as a Native American, they deal with the stone people. And I have developed, you know, some of that awareness myself, going out and picking, choosing a rock, a plant, something. Maybe it's a representational form, but the rock or crystal I have been able to program to give me a sense of connection and then remember that at a certain time. So to me, they were creating their own companions. A companion who was helping to get them through the process. And if you're uncomfortable, anxious, you remember by looking at that piece of rock, that piece of creation, and it says you're not alone. It's okay. We're in this together. I just, the beyond of what was going on there, I think is brilliant. And it's so simple, but we sometimes in our Western society don't see these tools and these wonderful pieces of our history across the world in the shamanic realm as being supportive and co-creating in the way that we work with our environment. I think it's just fascinating, all of the potential we have that we're still tapping. And you're helping that by saying, hey, come on, let's get off the drug kick.
Yeah, and I think we scorn simple tactics. You know, we may have a complicated meditation practice or whatever, Tai Chi practice, we may do something that serves us in a daily way that's lengthy, but we often don't have simple things to do, the 15-second things, the 10-second things, the touching our own icon around our neck things that actually make a difference in life. First, we need to do the work of figuring out our life purpose choices so that we know what's going on. But after that, I think we need a lot of tactics and strategies for keeping those life purposes alive.
But don't you think that comes down to self-worth?
Well, that's a huge part of it. I think everybody growing up in this contemporary culture, even whether they're religious or not religious, they're still infected with the idea that they're just excited matter passing through the universe and don't really matter. I think all of us are infected with that idea that we don't really matter from some cosmic perspective. Personally, I believe that's true. I don't think we matter from any cosmic perspective. I think, therefore, we have to matter to ourselves. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to communicate in the many books that I'm writing on the subject, is this paradigm shift from seeking meaning to making meaning, and to actually don the mantle of meaning maker, to understand that you're not going to matter to yourself unless you decide to matter to yourself. It's an intention, it's a decision, and it has to be followed up by the logical action, by the necessary actions that go with whatever meaning you've decided to make. So yes, I completely agree that a fundamental problem is folks not believing that they matter, and that's around the confusion of mattering in what sense. If they need to matter cosmically, well, maybe they don't. But if they need to matter to themselves, to their family, to their community, to their world, to their species, that's on their shoulders.
Okay, let me give you an example of a teeny tiny itty bitty relative action that will not get me a corporate gold star. But I work part-time. I enjoy it. It's something I have fun doing. It helps give me freedom from some of the other things that I am overwhelmed and totally fascinated by in my life. But I need boundaries and I need time out. So in that environment, we were assigned this. Everybody's getting the same amount of sales for the day. But what happened was, and there was an oversight, there were a couple of people that nobody was giving them any credit for their sales. And it's supposed to be shared. So in my own little way, I noticed and I went through and made sure and told somebody else, okay, start giving these folks sales. Everybody's going to get the same thing here. It's all going to be divided equally. But in that one little moment of observing and giving somebody else credit that they have no idea, nor will they, that this happened, but I happened to see there was a bias. And in an unintentional, it wasn't anything that was going to make or break the day. But in that way, I contributed that to this person long down the road. They won't have known, but I know that I gave somebody a fair shake when nobody else was able to see it. And I'm not saying that it was a bad thing. I'm just saying that I took a look, and that we all do that in our own way, and we discount the importance, the value in others' lives when we don't say, hey, I will help you, and it may not come back. There's no gold star. There's no reward, but it's a better and conscious awareness that we come to the table with, that it helps expand everybody's actions, because in the end, she got credit and everybody won. Does that make sense?
Sure. That's the essence of living our values and principles. And the longer phrase I use for making meaning is making value-based meaning, which is what you just said. There's inadvertent meaning. We experience meaning, we look up at the night sky and something awesome passes through us and what have you. That's not really value or principle-based meaning. That's just whatever it is, inadvertent meaning.
But then there's the meaning that are... Yeah, go ahead,
Then there's the meaning that arises because we're operating from our values and our principles, and that's the most important meaning. To circle back around to a big point about mattering and values and meaning, in the days before D-Day, we don't care what Eisenhower is feeling. We don't care what mood he's in. We don't care if he's anxious. We don't care if he's sad. We don't care. We need him to do D-Day right, because that's important. But we don't see our own life as a series of D-Day invasions. We don't take our life that seriously. It's hard to imagine our life being that important, but it must be to us. We want that same experience of life feeling that important. When it does, then we too feel less inclined to ask what mood we're in. To use a simple phrase here, then meaning trumps mood. It's more important what meaning we're making than what mood we find ourselves in. When we believe, when we act like we matter, then meaning can trump mood.
I tell you what, I just heard a review or an interview. I think it was the woman, Sheila Jordan. Somebody asked her, you know, you've been around forever. You're an icon. You're a superstar. You're absolutely the soul of jazz. But you're not a household name. Does that bother you? I'm thinking, what a question to put to somebody. She says, she's like, okay, so beyond the question, her answer was, as long as I continue doing what I'm doing, I'm happy. This is what I'm here to do. And her voice, when you listen to it, this is a voice of a master, a voice that's been absolutely honed, refined, defined, totally liberated, not confined, because of her beautiful, beautiful perspective. It wasn't the talent that she brings to it. It was the perspective that made it shine, in my opinion.
It's a super large point because that's what creative people want, the opportunity to do the work they want to do. Success is one thing, and of course we want success, but it's that opportunity. And that's what people mourn, what creative people mourn, is if they have to spend 60 hours a week doing something else in order to support their creative efforts, that just feels so meaningless. And it feels like such an imposition to have to spend those 60 hours just making the wheels of the universe go around smoothly, when in fact they just want to be singing or writing or whatever it is. I think if you're able to do the work you want to do, that is 78% of the battle. You're going to feel like you're living the life you were meant to live if you're allowed to do the work you really want to do. If you're not allowed to do it, you're going to be sad. You're going to be in that existential sadness place of not being able to fabricate a meaningful life because so many of your hours are being spent in meaningless pursuits.
Okay, real quickly, that existential Van Gogh thing. Can you go into that just briefly?
Let me just hit a highlight or two because it's a lot of moving parts to it. But whereas I think a baker is pretty clear as to the value of a loaf of bread, or a fire person is pretty clear as to why it's valuable to put out a fire. Creative people go in and out of their belief about the value of what they're doing. Does the world really need another photograph among the 5 trillion photographs that are out there? Does anyone need another poem? Does anyone need another short story? So the very meaningfulness of the activity of creating comes and goes for creative folks. And when it goes, it's an existential crisis. It's a meaning crisis. And it provokes intense sadness to suddenly feel like the activity of writing your novel doesn't feel meaningful anymore, or the activity of painting doesn't feel meaningful anymore. That's a piece of the puzzle. One of the challenges that confronts a creative person is the way in which the meaningfulness of the activity itself just vanishes. Just on some cloudy day, the feeling of what you're doing as meaningful goes away.
Well, and I think it's crucial to acknowledge that, because for me in life, you know, there are points when you think, well, why am I doing this? What worth is it? It doesn't, you know, it doesn't change things on the big scale, but it may in your neighborhood, it may in your community, it may in your family, it may in your own day-to-day being able to get up and go on about your business, whatever that might be. And so it's all in your mind, that existential thing. It gives it a nice frame of reference to say, I am creating. I can uncreate this. I can shift my perspective, because if you feel that you can bring it back into you and reform it, you have empowered your ability as a conscious creator. Does that make sense?
Yes, and you're right. It is all in the mind. And as the Buddha said, we need to get a grip on our mind. We need to think the thoughts that serve us. That's an important phrase, thinking thoughts that serve you. It's different from thinking true or false thoughts. Because lots of true thoughts don't serve us. For instance, Let's say I walk into a bookstore, I'm a writer, I walk into a bookstore, I see 5 trillion books around me, and I have the idle thought, wow, there are a lot of writers out there. That's a completely true thought. Nobody would doubt the veracity of that thought, but it's not a thought that serves me. Because 3 days later, I'm going to stop writing and not even know why I stopped writing, and I stopped writing because suddenly the thought of all those writers out there competing for these slots made me not want to try any longer. So if folks can get the idea that it's not important whether a thought is true or false, the only thing that's important is whether a thought serves you or not, that's a huge change to make, and it helps you align with your life purposes. And there's a three-step process for doing the thing I just said, namely only thinking thoughts that serve you. The first is the one you said, which is stop everything when something goes on. Instantly stop to see what's going on. Step one is to hear what you're saying to yourself. Step two is to dispute those utterances that don't serve you. And step three is to substitute more affirmative or more supportive language into your brain. Again, like so many things I talk about, this is really easy to do if a person will do it. If a person will start hearing what they're saying, disputing the thoughts that don't serve them and thinking thoughts that do serve them, that's a huge change in life. It's completely doable, but a person has to do them.
I want to know what your mantra is. What's your symbol? Do you have your icon and your mantra?
My mantra won't make sense to anyone else, which is fine. My mantra is process. That's my mantra. I believe in the reality of process. I don't pay lip service to it. I believe in it. I can't attach to outcomes. I can't know before I know. I start projects with high hopes and enthusiasm and what have you, but not attached to the project because I can't know. So I believe in the reality of process, including the reality that only a percentage of our creative efforts work. That's a piece of the reality of process. How many of Bob Dylan's 5 trillion songs are excellent? 38, 92, I don't know, but it's some percentage. For every creative person, only a percentage of their work works. So that's my mantra, is process. My icon is probably a postcard of Paris.
get out of here.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, there's something about that bohemian Paris thing that works for me. And the actual postcard changes over time with each trip. a new one replaces the old one. But those two things, process and a postcard of Paris, work just beautifully for me.
That's beautiful. Yes. Well, I was in the City of Lights. As soon as you said that, the City of Lights. And, you know, just spark the sparkles, the freedom. Yeah, bohemian.
That's right. But bohemian, but also an intellectual tradition, the existential tradition, etc. It's about certain traditions around freedom that are very important to me.
Well, and see, that's the deal. With one image, you have a whole framework. You have a universe. You have a complete universe in there that we don't know, but it makes you work. And that's the brilliance of this philosophy and why the psychology, without the mind-numbing drugs and the detours, give you a better grip on who you are as an individual. There's no distraction. There's just let's cut to the chase. Give me the foundation.
Right.
Give me the source.
And if you're a creative person, I think, you want to set up your non-religious altar. I mean, your altar of these kinds of icons in your working space, in your studio space, whether it's your postcard of Paris or whatever it is for you. I think we need sacred space in which to work. And even as a secular person, the phrase sacred space means something to me. The space we protect, the space that we don't let our retired husband walk on through just because he's retired and doesn't know what to do with himself. We need to protect the places where we're making meaning.
Okay. I'm sorry, but I got to go around the room because I have more than one icon. I've got a butterfly. All right. I've done that and it's there. I love it. But I'm looking at my room and my creative space. And I'm seeing a caricature of one of my dogs that I had, Max, who's just brilliant. And this caricature doesn't do him justice, but it's there. Behind me is a Wizard of Oz poster with Dorothy and the Tin Man and the Lion. And I've got a cat on the wall that I put on top of it, a wonderful saying, I may be little, but my angels are big. I have a green stuffed monkey over on the other side with sunflowers. And I have a lemon tree that my husband gave me with nice ripe lemons on it by the door and by the window. And in the window is a flying pig activated by sunlight. Okay, this is just a few.
That's right.
My sacred icons that say,
I think we would call that a menagerie.
And who said punk rock music? My guy, my guy on the screen just tagged in and goes, Matt, and punk rock music. Oh, yeah. Okay, well, maybe not that much.
Well, don't play it too loud. It's hard to write if the music's too loud.
Well, and on my calendar, it says, speak to be heard, read to grow, write to be understood. You know, these are things that keep me going.
Yes.
And talking with people like you who share this message in so many multiple forms, your books, your presentations, the deal coming up in February where you've got people free access to learn about these kinds of topics. It's just a way we all grow and we all benefit from the presence of each other. No matter how big or how small, each has something to add. And I think it's a wonderful time to be here to connect in this way.
Absolutely. I want to just say to folks, you know, we threw out the whole mental health thing quickly. And of course, we only had X amount of time for it. But I want to let folks get a free resource if they're interested. The clinical division of the British Psychological Society this month is putting out a huge, they call it a report, but it's really a book-length thing called Understanding Psychosis. It's free. If you go to their site, you can download it. I think it's the best updated stuff on how to think about some of these mental health issues. So if a listener is interested in the things we're talking about, then I recommend that they download that free report as soon as it appears. I think it should have appeared by now. It's going to appear the end of November, and I guess we're into December now.
Yeah. Well, you're proactive in the area of natural psychology, creative coaching, natural psychology. More natural psychology is what?
It's adding to traditional psychology a better understanding of meaning and life purpose. Oddly enough, traditional psychology doesn't interest itself in meaning or life purpose, as if human beings did care about such things. If you're sitting with your therapist, or if you're reading Freud, or you're reading whatever, questions about what meaning is and how to articulate your life purposes virtually never come up. So I thought the idea of creating a psychology that I'm calling natural psychology that included meaning and life purpose would be an antidote to the more mental disorder, abnormal psychology way of looking at things that we typically do. Too often, we're pathologizing ordinary behavior. We're, as we said earlier, we're pathologizing squirming in church or saying no to your teacher or what have you, as if that was a medical condition. So I'm very interested in including our goals, our aspirations, our dreams, our desires in our view of psychology.
See, in my experience, when I have people come to me, because as being an intuitive and having these alternative awarenesses that don't always fit into the traditional form of being sane, they usually say, am I crazy? What is wrong with me? And I'm saying, no. Let's go back. Retrace. First, tell me what you are seeing. Let's validate your vision, your experience, and then go what direction we need in terms of sane. Because there are so many alternative awarenesses and states of being and seeing and experience. And I've had some mind-blowing experiences. It doesn't make me better. It doesn't make me higher knowing. It makes me paying attention. Okay. And in some way, that gives me a grounding and knowing that there's more here than meets the eye. And until we acknowledge that and validate people for some of their unexplainable experiences, we're going to be stuck. And we're going to be stuck with drugs to make those things go away.
That's
right. Does that
make sense? And again, as far as resources go, I would recommend a website called madinamerica.com. It has a lot of interesting bloggers. It's based on the book called Mad in America. So that's something that I would recommend. And there's also something called the Hearing Voices Network of people who hear voices and have different ways of explaining that than the medical model. So there's a lot out there. For a person looking for an alternative vision, there's a lot out there. As I said earlier, it's just hard to realize there's a lot out there when we're bombarded by chemical ads all day long. But there are lots of resources out there for someone who wants to look at this whole subject in a different way.
We just need about 5 more hours with you.
I have to get a snack first.
You what?
I have to get a snack first.
Oh, you have to get a snack. Okay, fine. We'll break them up in bite-sized pieces, okay? But yeah, the resources available now are so wonderful, because before we weren't as connected and these things had to be talked about behind closed doors, and people were very afraid of disclosing some of their experiences for being ridiculed or labeled or outcast and all those good things. In the meantime, today's book is Life Purpose Bootcamp. All right. The 8-week breakthrough plan. Engage, become, explore, allow, create yourself. ericmaisel.com. Okay. Check it out. Find the resources that resonate and work for you, and you'll benefit. All right. We can't predict an outcome, but that's up to you. That's up to you. Eric, thank you so much for your time and your contributions.
Thanks, Wendy. It was great being with you.
And you have a wonderful day wherever you are, whatever you're doing. Remember, you are here for a reason. Explore, enjoy, create. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.